You're listening to Section D, a first broadcast on the 22nd of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to a very special episode of Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Josh Fannett. Today, we look back on the best of 2015, including a repartee with Italian architect Renzo Piano.
They are being built in a kind of lack of interest and affection, but in reality, despite this, sometimes you can find beauty in the periphery.
We head to Sheffield to discover how the city's second annual Design Week is sharpening up its image. We also talk to typographer extraordinaire Michael Beirut and Brazilian architect Issei Weinfeld, not to mention cracking the spine of Monocle's latest publishing project. All that to come on this very special 2015 roundup of Section D on Monocle 24. We start our annual roundup in February when Monocle's David Pleasant caught up with architect Renzo Piano. Piano's architectural triumphs include the Pompidou Centre in Paris, the New York Times Building and London's Soaring Shard. Now 77 years old, the Italian is showing no signs of resting on his laurels. For the past few years, Renzo Piano has been investing in a young architecture and design collective named G124 that hopes to revive Italy's long-overlooked and derelict buildings. Monocle's design correspondent David Pleasant spoke to the Italian architect to find out more.
Well, it's a very old idea, actually. I've been always attracted by the idea of the periphery of towns, you know, the suburbs. First, because I was born myself in a suburb. I was born in Genoa, but in the western part of Genoa. And then, after that, I've been working so many times on suburbs, on the idea of the part of the city that is normally neglected. Typically, the word periphery is associated with a bad reputation. Poor, sad, abandoned. In reality, I mean, it's not like that. In reality, there are fantastic beauties in the peripheries. Energy is there. But it's also sometimes even physical. I mean, sometimes the suburbs show a beauty for which they have not been built. You know, they are being built in a kind of lack of interest and affection. But in reality, despite this, sometimes you can find beauty in the periphery.
You speak of that beauty and your interest, your personal interest in the suburbs and the periphery. But in many ways, as you've mentioned as well, it is an area in many cities that's been criticised as a sort of failure, also on the part of the architect, of the planner, who perhaps made certain mistakes, especially in the area of the suburbs in, say, the 1960s and 70s. Do you feel in a way your project is trying to right some wrongs of that period, or is it a different approach?
No, this is exactly what you say. I mean, it's evident that the periphery needs attention because something went wrong there. Somebody sometime asked me, what is the city of the future? And my answer is typically, it's the periphery. I mean, the periphery of cities are the city of the future. And if they don't become city, urbanize it, civilized places, then is going to be a problem. It's already a problem. If you talk about Paris, for example, but even London, all the big cities. In Paris, it's typical. The so-called banlieue parisienne, the banlieue, the periphery of Paris, is the center of many, many social disease and terrible tension. So it's exactly the reason why we need to put our attention there. You know, nowadays, for the next probably 30 or 40 or 50 years, after having built bad peripheries, bad place to stay and to live, the bigger challenge now is to work on those mistakes. And typically mistakes don't need only 5 or 10 years. They need a full generation of people, probably a couple of generations of people. People must understand one thing. In all the cities, the 90% of people live in the periphery. I mean, the people live in the so-called center are only 10%. And so the energy of the city, the desire, the big desire of change, are in the periphery. This is where energy is, in the good, in the bad. So it's quite evident that it's a big challenge. It doesn't take years, it will take decades, but somebody must start to do that.
And can I ask you, Senator, how impractically, you've talked wonderfully about the theory and the history of the suburb, as it were, but practically with the G124, for instance, you've decided that you'll rotate the team, as it were, you'll keep it fresh. Maybe explain that. How are you kind of hands-on? How are you controlling and vetting the people involved in the designs?
There's something that you start to understand when you are a certain age, that it's a pleasure. It's a real pleasure to pass what you know to other people. And that's the reason why in my office, in our office, we have a little foundation, and we have young people coming from all around the world. They stay with us, they work with us. So it's a kind of familiar thing for me to spend part of my day talking to young people, giving to young people the example. At a certain age, talk or speech don't help. I mean, the only thing that helps is the example. So you sit there and you show. Last year, for the first year, we've been selecting through 600 people, six people. This year, we've been selecting through again, about 600 people. We selected four people. And I meet those people. Tomorrow, by example, I meet them here in my office in Genoa, but in 1 month, I will meet them in the office in Rome at the Senate. They work full-time, of course. They have a tutor. So, and the tutor are people coming from my office, maybe people that have been working in my office long time ago and now they are still around. And we select a specific situation in a specific place, in a specific town. Last year we went in Catania, that is a city in Sicily, or Rome and Torino. And this year we are still selecting the place, will be on the north part of Italy, but you know, we keep going around and we find specific place where energy is already, you know, because you can't do anything without energy coming from people. And there is a lot of energy in the suburbs. A lot of energy.
And maybe on that if I could interrupt on that subject of energy and maybe the results of some of the work of the G124, let's talk about some of the tangible sites.
One in Catania is a very utopic project from Kenzo Tanji that made the kind of general plan 50 years ago. The result of Librino is that place, is a neighborhood of Catania, is a disaster. Socially speaking, urbanistically speaking, no public space. In the middle of that disaster, we found a group called the Briganti. The Briganti, the people that occupied a sports center, abandoned it, and they started to help young people in the streets, bringing them to that place, to make gym, to make football, to play music, and to do this. Totally illegal. So we started to work with those people, and we made legal what was illegal. There was a very small project, because they have to last 1 year, they have to cost nothing, because money, of course, is negative, so we have to do that. I mean, the money for this project comes from my salary, that's all. And I have a salary as a senator, and I use that salary. But we don't accept donation for that. We try to do everything with the energy coming from people. And so at the end, what happened is that we do very little. But it's more touching the consciousness of people. So, you know, the result we are expecting from those projects is not big in terms of physical result. We are not talking about making big building or big things. You will never do that in a short time or with no money. But you can do a lot in building up the consciousness of people, young people and everybody, about the fact that the city is still a great invention of the man. And in Italian, città and civiltà are the same word, by the way. City and civilization are the same word. And this is what is good about city. It's also what is bad about city when it doesn't work. But that's our duty, to transform the bad in the good. So that's why working on the suburbs is so important for me.
That was Italian architect Renzo Piano speaking to Monocle's David Pleasant back in February. Next on the show, we head to Slovenia, where Monocle's intrepid correspondent Guy Delorne attended the world's oldest biennial of the graphic arts, which this year celebrates its Diamond Jubilee. Since 1955, Slovenia's capital of Ljubljana has hosted the world's finest examples of graphic design. With its roots in the socialist ideals of Tito's Yugoslavia, the city's designers have long celebrated the idea that art is for the many rather than the few. The biennial has dealt with major changes over the past 25 years, from Slovenian independence to the impact of the internet. But the latest edition showed that the event isn't afraid of stepping into new territory. Our correspondent Guy Delorne went to Ljubljana for the grand opening and brought us this special report.
It's the opening evening of the Graphic Arts Biennial, and the party is in full swing here in Ljubljana on a sweltering summer's evening. At the controls, VJ Mina Fina, who happened to design the graphic identity for this whole biennial, and she's projecting manipulated images, cut-ups of the designs that she made for the biennial onto the walls of the beautiful building, which is the headquarters of the International Institute for Graphic Art.
Hello, I'm Mina Fina. I'm a graphic designer, artist and a VJ. I really like because it brings diversity to your community. And you can find more about what's going on inside this big field of contemporary graphic art, which is now like really diverse, and we are still trying to find what is graphic art and what isn't.
For Ljubljana to have this every 2 years, the oldest graphic arts biennial in the world, one of the oldest arts biennials in the world, that's got to be tremendous in terms of fostering graphic artists and graphic designers here in Slovenia.
I think whenever the field of art is opening up, that's always good, that it's not closed off, or that you have different approaches and directions that you can see in person, that you get new contacts. I mean, yeah, of course it's great.
When you meet people from the Ljubljana design and art scene, you realise they wear multiple hats. Because Slovenia's a very small country, they simply can't afford to limit themselves to just one field. So Mina also does commercial graphic design work with Grupa A. As far as she's concerned, all these different elements cross-pollinate her creativity, including the visual identity she designed for the biennial.
Maybe it's good that we don't have black and white definitions and that we can easily travel from one field to another, because I think I'm very lucky I can live in a time when I have three professions at the same time. So it's good that I'm not in a rut, so I can, you know, be flexible with this and I can choose my own time when to do things.
You've created the visual identity for the 2015 biennial. What were you thinking about when you did this? The obvious touch points would be people like Bridget Riley and Pete Mondrian, the use of the geometric forms and the colours, both monochrome and colour. What were you thinking when you came up with this?
When you do graphic design, you always think of art references or the use of colors, but also this is jubilee, it's like 60th edition of the biennial, so I looked through all the old catalogs that they have, so I picked some colors that they used in the 70s, 80s, so I used some typical colors from that period and I put everything together, and then black and white, it's obvious choice because of like it's graphic art, and mostly when I do like silk screen and other, mostly I use only black and white. Mm. So I wanted that when you look at the poster, you have a feeling that there are many copies behind and there can be many copies in the future.
Well, this may be the graphic art biennial, but the curator is really stretching the definition of what makes graphic art. For example, as you come up the staircase in the International Institute of Graphic Art, you have a series of sculptures, busts of a face, each one of them slightly different. As we move into another room, we've got a gold painted cardboard model of Josef Plesnik's design, rejected in the end, for a Slovenian parliament. Again, this is 3D. It's not what you might think of as graphic art.
So I'm Nicola Lees, and I'm a curator of the Graphic Art Biennial in Ljubljana in 2015. It's the 31st edition and the 60th anniversary. Everything in the biennial has the potential to be reproduced. So there's a lot of mirroring, there's a lot of doubling, there's a lot of facsimiles, there's a lot of print, also digital print. Also on the promenade, Will Benedict has done 200 posters, very graphic, but also has a political context in connection to activism and climate change and the distribution of water. And Pilar Quinteros, an artist from Chile, came, made this incredible sculpture of Plesnik's proposal for the parliament, which was never built, but actually was proposed to be built on the castle. He wanted to demolish the castle and replace it with his...
But that one done well.
But it's also one of the most reproduced images because it was on the coin, even though it was never made. And she made a cardboard model of this, and it's gold, and she's floated it on a raft down the river. But the other thing that's interesting about the hint of graphics is also this reference to paper, the material.
So with your extensive international experience, I want to try and put the Ljubljana Graphic Arts Biennial in context. Yeah. How important is this event in the arts world, and particularly, I suppose, in graphic arts?
The Biennial in Ljubljana is incredibly important because it's one of the oldest biennials in the world. It was set up in 1955. We're very close to Venice here, so they were the context of, obviously, the Venice Biennial being the first biennial. They wanted to deconstruct some of the hierarchies that maybe were the structure of Venice. There was a kind of philosophy behind it, and the really radical thing about the early biennials is that they were a kind of art for all idea with graphics, which is something that I'm particularly interested in. This idea that actually it was something, there was a scale to it that also meant that everyone could have works in their homes, and also a lot of the graphic arts sort of can be produced on a kitchen table. And also it's something that could be easily sort of posted and sort of cross international borders. And I think also the early biennials were also particularly interesting as this kind of the position of Ljubljana as this space sort of between this kind of east and west. So I'm really interested in that. But the thing that I think is really contemporary about graphics is not to be medium specific, because I think when you're working with artists, it's always good to sort of invent new rules and not be too rigid in a creative process.
This is one of the main streets in Ljubljana, Slovenska. It's recently been closed to motorised traffic and only bicycles are allowed through for the moment. And right next to United Colours of Benetton, there's an extremely colourful display. We've got window after window in the NAMA department store dedicated to the designs from the Graphic Arts Biennial. These very colourful red, blue, yellow, black and white bold designs, really illustrating how the Graphic Design Biennial becomes part of the city.
The thing that's been fascinating for us is also looking at Plesnik, the famous architect. And so the street lights are designed by Plesnik. We have work, and Pilar Quinteros' piece is referring to Plesnik. The city is incredibly precise and beautiful, and actually a lot of artists were involved in the planning of the city, and Plesnik somehow is, you know, a great architect, and many of his things are artworks, really. And so that for me is even interesting, that how art became something that was integrated into the function of how a city sort of flows.
Ljubljana really does feel like a work of art on a late summer's evening. You can meander along the river, which winds its way through the city centre, perhaps admiring the beautiful old buildings. Or you can stop at one of the old squares, now cleared of traffic and opened up as public spaces for performances, from jazz to gamelan, or in this case, a circle of torch-lit gong beaters. It contributes to a creative atmosphere for local designers,
including Miran Moha, who mixes commercial work with artistic and political poster actions with his group New Collectivism. Making fly posters critical of the government could be a hazardous activity in the years of Yugoslavia, and Miran's contribution to this year's biennial is a life-sized reproduction of his group in graphic guerrilla mode in the 1980s.
What we are seeing are our actions postering the city, but in fact, in this project, the size of the figures is 1-to-1, so they are 170 by 80 centimeters. So we are basically exhibiting the event, the time, the process where we are posting, and the posters, because we are the size of 1-to-1 figures, the posters are also of the real size.
So it's an exhibition about the posting of the posters.
It's an exhibition about posting the posters.
It's quite meta.
Yes, meta.
For the uninitiated, all this can seem rather mind-bending. But that's all part of the plan. The modern spirit of the Graphic Arts Biennial is to make people look at things in different ways. And for artists and designers, working within the philosophy of reproducible works and honouring the history of the event is a creative challenge to be relished.
No, I think the specific with the biennial is that it has a frame, a historical frame we have to deal with, you know, historical frame of this graphic tradition. And, you know, limitations in this world are very welcome today. Because when anything goes, the limitation is something what kind of forces you to discipline yourself. Not to say anything is possible, I can choose anything, but you always have to think how this goes to this conceptual frame or historical frame. And that, I think, is the power of this Biennale, because it has to deal with it. It has to answer also this question, to position itself. It's clear that the curator, Nicola, she knows the history, she knows the context, she includes the local art scene in the Biennale. Because many times Biennales are like the cloud, no connection with the city whatsoever, just international crowd which comes and go over the weekend.
That's certainly not the case in Ljubljana, where the exhibitions and events will run until the end of the year and form an enjoyably unavoidable part of the city's fabric. Much like the train line that runs through the city and the promenade that links it to Tivoli Park and the headquarters of the Graphic Arts Institute. The biennial has taken over this shady lane, not just with the 200 posters which offer the traditional face of graphic art, but the Plechnik-designed lights, which initially seem to have gone on the blink. Instead of producing a steady glow, these illuminated columns turn on and off, occasionally plunging the promenade into darkness. Naturally, it's another exhibit at the biennial, There Is No East and West by Asad Raza, and it could hardly be easier for the public to access. Just go for an evening stroll and hope you don't trip over in the dark. The Ljubljana Graphic Arts Biennial does remain incredibly accessible. Everything is free to enter, and much of it is happening on the streets. There's everything from traditional techniques to 3D printing and GIFs, marvellous mechanical creatures to piles of earth with mirrors planted in them like headstones. And all of this feeds into the city's creative community and the daily life of the people who live here for 3 months every 2 years. It's one remnant of Yugoslavia that continues to thrive. Here's to the next 60 years. For Monocle, in Ljubljana, I'm Guy Delaunay.
That was Monocle correspondent Guy Delaunay there, reporting from the Ljubljana Biennial of Graphic Arts. Still to come in the show, we talk to two legends in their field. Graphic designer Michael Beirut visits me in studio, and Brazilian architectural legend Issei Weinfeld talks architecture and quality of life. We also dive under the covers of Monocle's latest book offering and talk to contributing editor Tom Morris about what makes for a cosy home. All that to come on this very special roundup of Section D in 2015 with me, Josh Fennett. Next up on the show, we discuss Monocle's latest book project with German publisher Gestalten. Available since September 2015, the 400-page linen-bound beauty takes readers through a few of our favourite examples of homes, towns, cities and countries to put down roots in. The Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is a practical purchase too. Expect a directory of designers and architects to call, homeware products worth purchasing, and the retailers we'd recommend wherever in the world you find yourself. To get some insights into the book, I spoke to Monocle's contributing editor, Tom Morris, who handled the project, to find out a few more home truths about this alluring new title.
I think we sort of came up with the idea that, you know, there are so many good design books out there and good home books and interiors books, but they all kind of give a very pristine, a very perfect image of the home. Whereas I think in Monocle, we like to do things a little bit more practically and a little bit differently. So we came up with this idea of an actual guide to sort of teach you, you know, it goes through the basics of how to actually achieve your perfect home. And then there's lots of kind of visual inspiration in there too. The first sort of, I think like 2/3 of the book are just kind of beautiful homes that we featured in the magazine over the years. So it's practical, but it's, you know, it's an aesthetic joy to look at too.
And you alluded there to the front of the book, which is a bit of a glossy romp through existing properties from lush villas in Brazil to islands on the Swedish archipelago. Can you talk me through maybe some of your favourites and maybe through how you selected these from both Monocle's back catalogue and kind of the new ideas that came in? I mean, what were you looking to sum up and what were the highlights?
It was quite interesting to see how our take on interiors has changed over the years. In the beginning, it was used a lot of quite perfect homes and very sort of pristine, without people in them, without stuff in them. And then kind of gradually over the years, the homes we're interested in have got a bit more sort of crappy, you know, books, like shelves full of books, ornaments everywhere. The garden might not be perfect, but it looks like a nice sort of place to spend an afternoon in. So it's kind of pulling all of these together, choosing ones that have character, have a bit of definition about them. And then we came up with the idea to call the book The Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes, and that became quite sort of a good unifying theme for the book. The first one I love is the home in the Danish countryside owned by the CEO of Carl Hansen. It's like sort of, I think it's like 10-bedroom, huge, huge mansion. The inside is just full of like old Hans Wegner prototypes and things, just the most amazing furniture, beautiful garden, just a really nice, cozy family home. There's the Marcio Kogan in there, which I'd love to live in, which is a bit more of a sort of a tropical cozy flavour. There's plenty of very nice homes I'd like to set up in.
And if we were to dive under the covers with you, Tom Morris, what could we expect to find in the way of other quirky chapters and features in the book? There are some beautiful illustrations, as you mentioned, the architects call on the product. There's a very interesting chapter about kind of flat plans and how our homes change with us over time and our kind of expectations of the built environment are different. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the others beyond the residences and the kind of resources, some of the other things that we touched on in the book?
So we came up with this idea of stages of life, which is to sort of look at how parts of your home, rooms of your home, elements of your home change as you get older. So it's a sort of, you know, it's a decade by decade, blow by blow look at how a kitchen evolves as you grow up. In your 20s, you know, you've probably got a little microwave and a sink. By the time you get to your 60s, you've got two sinks and a walk-in pantry and, you know, all of those things. Plants, you know, in your 20s, you've got a pot of basil in the kitchen. That's probably the extent of it. When you're 30s, you might have a window box. 40s, you've got a balcony. 50s, you've probably got a huge rolling lawn. And then 60s, you probably downsized again back to a window box with a bonsai tree. So it's looking at life, which is what this book is about. It's about living and about life. It's not about design necessarily or just about homes. And yeah, the illustrated stages of life, it's definitely my favourite section. And it was really fun to do as well. We worked with a great Japanese illustrator on it. Me and Poppy Shimoto, our esteemed photo director. Yeah, we had a lot of fun doing that one.
And one of the sections of the book is a part that I particularly like. It's a section called Home Truths, in which we canvass the opinions of Monocle's editors, of writers, architects, designers, and ask them basically to write about something which isn't their work, which isn't, you know, why they're a chef or an esteemed architect. It's, you know, about the idea of home. I wonder if you can pull up any of those that you enjoyed, or if there are any take homes for you, particularly from working on the book, about the idea of home that kind of, you know, became clear over the course of compiling the book.
I think it goes back to what we're kind of doing with the stages of life section. I think the home goes beyond the four walls. The home is the most important thing, whether we own it or we don't, but certainly in our lives. And I think it has such resonance in all our other parts of life. So it's great in there. We sort of had real fun with We got Ruth Rogers to talk about how to build the perfect kitchen, which, you know, she goes in there about its food preparation, you know, being practical, but it's not really about kitchens at all. It's about, you know, the being the center of the home. There's an amazing essay in there by a lady called Jane Wan, who lives, she works at the Bexhill Pavilion, the De La Varr Pavilion down in, on the south coast of England. She's the curator there. And she, and the stairs are the most satisfying depth. When you walk up them, they're just amazing. So she wrote this whole essay about the pitch perfect stair, because she was brought up, I think, in South Korea, where stairs you don't really find. It's either elevators in apartment blocks or escalators in shopping malls.
That was Monocle's very own contributing editor, Tom Morris, talking to me about Monocle's latest publishing project, The Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes, which is available at all good bookshops.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to a very special roundup episode of Section D, featuring our favourite reports and interviews from 2015. Next up, I talk to one of the graphic design world's leading lights. Michael Beirut is a partner in the New York office of international design consultancy Pentagram. Born in Ohio, he started his career under the instruction of the late great Massimo Vignelli and has, for the past 35 years, worked with clients including United Airlines and the New York Times and plenty more besides. As well as writing countless essays and garnering innumerable awards, Beirut is a teacher at the Yale School of Art, as well as a co-founder of the Design Observer website. September saw the launch of a monograph that charts 35 projects from Beirut's generation-defining work. Entitled How To, the book from Thames and Hudson presents everything from sketches to finished products that show the development of some of Beirut's most intriguing projects. I sat down with Michael Beirut right here in London to find out more about the man, his career, and how to solve some of the graphic design world's most pressing problems.
Each one of the projects that I selected to put in the book had to be something that I was proud of and that I thought, delivered something in terms of their final visual form. But also each of them had also to have a story behind it that I thought had a lesson that was a little bit more, if not universal, than just extendable to a lot of different situations. So there are a few projects in the book where I quite frankly got off to a terrible start, you know, lost my way to a certain degree. I was asked to do an identity for a cultural organization in Miami, Florida called New World Symphony. And I kept doing just one successively more misguided solution after another. And part of my problem was that I was listening too much to the voices in my own head and not kind of attending to what my client was telling me. My client is internationally known conductor and performer named Michael Tilson Thomas. He actually has a tremendous amount of taste, but I remember in that project being quite besotted by my own professionalism. I think I was intimidated by him slightly, and I thought, well, if you're the best conductor, I'll be the best graphic designer, and it'll be this great meeting of the minds. And I really underestimated how much I could learn just by shutting up and listening to him, as opposed to drowning him with my own ideas. And so in the book, it was really sobering and relieving to see that after so many false starts, I finally came around and got something right. So sometimes it really is a bit of a struggle to find the right way to a solution. In other cases, there are examples in the book where I think it's just a result of methodical, hard work. We did a pedestrian wayfinding system for the city of New York, very similar to Legible London that you have here. There's dozens, if not hundreds, of minute decisions that were made, everything from bigger ones like what color scheme to use in the maps or how to represent streets and parks in the maps or what typeface to use on the graphics overall. But then we determined that to get it exactly right, we'd have to go in and kind of make slight alterations to every one of the icons that appear very small in the map to make them coordinate more carefully with the typeface we chose. And as we were doing that work, we did it knowing that it wasn't designed so anyone would notice and admire it. It was just designed so the overall effect was just maybe 1/10 of 1 degree more integrated and hence pleasing to someone trying to decipher the map and actually achieve a goal bigger than admiring graphic design, which was how to get to where they wanted to go from where they were by looking at a map, something that all of us do all the time.
A lot of the chapters, and indeed the whole idea of the book is this kind of how-to, but a lot of the chapters, as you mentioned, have kind of very esoteric lessons. I mean, how to put a big sign on a glass building without blocking the view is obviously one of the one of the more idiosyncratic titles, and that's the New York Times building in New York. Did you choose that way of expressing the chapter titles because that's how you approach the projects? Do you see that as your goal very much, to be the problem solver and to take these big issues and boil them down to their simplest or the most legible solution?
Yes, one of the challenges that I think any creative professional working with clients and collaborating with other people face is as you're coming up with these potential solutions, your ideas, how do you portray them in a way that other people can kind of access them? I mean, some people will just simply say, I'm a genius, stand back and behold. And for some people that works. That's never been my style. I've always been a little bit more of a, someone who sort of really needs to assumes that I'm going to have to persuade someone to accept the thing that I've come up with, not just because they should defer to me because I'm a designer, but because I've done something that's appropriate for the situation that they've put me into. I think in the case of, say, the New York Times building, it was a really big challenge. It's just one of those cases where because of where the New York Times building is in the city of Manhattan or in the borough of Manhattan, it's required by zoning to have a big sign on it because it's in the Times Square district and they made a decision that all buildings in Times Square need to have big signs and then to preserve the character of Times Square. The architect Renzo Piano had designed a building that was almost entirely glass and steel. And so the challenge of putting a block-long logo on a building that has nowhere to put that logo was actually kind of, at the end of the day, the problem that had to be solved. And described that way, you can actually show a client, you can show the people in that situation, look, this is your problem, and there's a number of different ways to solve it, and here's the one that I've come up with. Once you sort of describe the situation to them that way, it makes it less about taste or less about just kind of reacting viscerally to something. Valid ways to respond to a aesthetic presentation. But it actually focuses people on the functional things that have to be satisfied before we can get on to the matter of taste, beauty, and those other important things.
And finally, I guess a monograph inevitably charts the course of something. I know these 35 projects, I don't think they're chronological. They're all different ideas. They're all different projects that have different kind of driving forces. But I wonder, you know, after 25 years as a partner at Pentagram, how the way that you approach a problem as a designer has changed. If you had been asked to put this book together 25 years ago, would the how-to have been very different? And how different would it have been?
Early on in my career, when I started out, I was really enchanted by what I now would call cleverness. And I thought that regardless of what other things I had to accomplish with each design assignment, I had to be sure to demonstrate to people that the guy who did this was clever as hell, right? And if I didn't sort of like have that element in it, I sort of think it was a missed opportunity, if not an outright failure. When I look at the work that I admire that's endured, whether it's people like Lance Wyman or Massimo Vignelli or Margaret Calvert or Alan Fletcher, you name it. Some of it is indeed clever, but a lot of it just has a enduring intelligence and simplicity that I think sort of transcends cleverness. And there's something a little bit coercive about clever. It's like a sharp elbow in the ribs, and it means I want you to get this one thing. Did you get it or not? And if the answer is yes, victory. If not, failure. And it's very binary, right? It leaves no room to wiggle on the part of the recipient of that message. And some of the things that I've really come to really admire are things that actually are simple, even ambiguous. And I find when I look back on the work I've done here, there's a little bit of a transition from things that were indeed very clever that I did when I was younger to things that are a little bit more open-ended towards the more recent examples, but I can sort of see the next phase of work I would do, really just experimenting with how ubiquitous can you make design? How can you make it play even more of a part in people's lives so that it is sometimes barely visible to them? Certainly not crying for attention or waving hands frantically, look at me, but just playing a role to improve people's lives, help them find their way around, help them understand something better without calling any attention to itself whatsoever.
Well, I think that's a great point, but do you think the industry would acknowledge that? Do you think cleverness is exclusive and ubiquity is something that people are deciding that design should be? It should be ubiquitous, it should be easy, it should be simple? Or do you think that's just something you've discovered over time?
In a way, I'm sort of discovering something that a lot of people already know, and I suspect a lot of people think, why would you do it any other way? But there's something about the process of becoming a designer, and this is any kind of designer, I'd say an architect, fashion designer, interior designer, product designer, graphic designer. When you're learning your trade, when you're in design school, say, there's a really high premium just put on individual performance and innovation, imagination, you know, trying to do the thing that really will stand out in a degree show, let's say. You know, that's what school is for. And what it's not doing is really preparing you for a life where the work you're doing should live beyond the last day of the term, you know, and go on a year later, 2 years later, 5 years later, 10 years later, still people would encounter it somehow, and it would work just as well, even work better. And I can't think of any way to learn that in school. It's lived experience that sort of teaches you the value of that. So I think I may be discovering something that a few young people may have known in a prescient sort of way miraculously before I did, but a lot of older people seem to learn as they amass experience. So I may be late to the party, but I'm entering enthusiastically.
That was Michael Beirut talking to me in studio right here in London. His wonderful new monograph, it was published by Thames & Hudson in September and is available now. Next up, we meet a master of Brazilian modernist architecture. As a leader of the tropical modernism movement, Issei Weinfeld has worked extensively in his home nation and abroad across sectors including residential buildings, commercial spaces, and even hotels. During the Monocle Quality of Life conference in Lisbon this April, our contributing editor Tom Morris spoke to Issei Weinfeld to discuss how to build the perfect home.
I feel 95% of the places, I think people just copy what they saw in a magazine. And then you see places designed by interior designers or architects that is beautiful, photographed in a magazine, but has no life. And this is not a home. Then the role of an architect, of an interior designer, first, this affinity with the client is so important, because if you take a job that you know that the client will go forward, they will take your project forward, a step in many steps, every day changing. Because what I hate is you see a house and finished by a professional that you feel it's the look of the professional. This is why I'm always saying that I could never live in a place that I designed, because I'm not designing for myself. Yeah. It's for another family. It has to do with them. It's difficult to find people also that can, that like to buy, like the mess. This is home. This is not a house to win an award and to be featured in a magazine. This is fake. And I really don't appreciate works that I can see the hand of the architect.
But there is a sort of, I guess, a slight contradiction there in the fact that, to me, my idea of a perfect home would probably be a home designed by you. You have a kind of a very sort of identifiable style that I think a lot of clients must come to you because they want that look that's very much your signature. How do you sort of work with that when you design a home for someone that's the very looks like it's come from your drawing board, but then you encourage them to decorate as they please or add their things? Do a lot of your clients want that, or do they just want to buy a house by you?
No, if they want to buy, I can feel, and I don't take this project anymore for many years, because I know that when they give me, you have total freedom to do it. We just want exactly what you do. This is not something interesting for me.
And I mean, a lot of your work is obviously in Brazil, in your homeland, and obviously designing homes in Brazil come with it certain pressures. And I'm thinking sort of the security measures in particular. I mean, you mentioned today about, you know, the huge sort of security walls that you have to build and little guard houses and stuff. What are the other kind of any special pressures or things that designing a house in Brazil entails?
As we have this problem, we still have, but we are trying to remove these fences in our projects in these big walls. Unfortunately, because I like the relation between the private home and the street, but as you cannot see the house from outside, I try to turn the house to the site and to have maximum relation with the garden that they can, at least to have something that they have some privacy, because unfortunately they need. And then most of the time I turn the house with the back to the street. That this is not a good solution, but it's depending on where are you building. And in São Paulo, most of the time, till now, we design like this because we need to. But it's part of the work. Like you have the rules from the city, like you have the budget, like you have the sun, where is the sun, and like you have the program of the house. Then you have this security, and the final work is the result of everything together. Trying to answer, again, your last question that I forgot to mention, that I hate to repeat myself. Then if a client comes with asking to repeat, because this is, again, something that I have no motivation, because I like so many things. To find a style for me or to print, you know, a label, it's the beginning of a decadence of an artist, or to have a formula. And then when you finally find a formula and you want to repeat yourself because it's easy for you, you can have money and do the same thing. This is exactly what I hate.
That was Brazilian architectural legend Issei Weinfeld speaking to our contributing editor Tom Morris during Monocle's Lisbon Quality of Life Conference last April. Last up on this roundup of Section D from 2015, we head north from our base here in London to a city known worldwide for its cutlery. September saw the city of Sheffield in northern England host its second annual Design Week, and as willing patrons of less obvious as well as larger shifts in the industry, we dispatched Monocle's Henry Rees Sheridan to find out more about how the city known for blades is forging a contemporary new identity.
If I asked you to think of a contemporary design hub, Sheffield might not be the first place to spring to mind. But the city has a proud design heritage, rooted in its status as an industrial powerhouse in the 19th and 20th centuries. Sheffield Design Week looks to build on these foundations to stimulate and promote design in the city. I'm going to begin my day here in Sheffield by meeting up with the event's founder and director, Patrick Murphy, who is also the director of Made North, the design platform that Sheffield Design Week grew out of.
I think it's probably a good idea to explain what Made North is, and then that'll go on to explain or give foundation for Sheffield Design Week. We formed Made North about 3.5 years ago with essentially the remit of trying to promote northern design, northern designers. It came from a background, I'm a graphic designer as a profession, and moved into sort of design curation in the last sort of 10 years. But it was to sort of try to get and promote a background that exists in the north of really good design, and there's some really good design projects that happen. And it was to sort of try and create a platform that can promote that, really. And it was initially influenced by things like what the Scandinavian and Danish governments did in terms of promoting their own region in terms of a design product. So in the 50s, I think Danish and Scandinavian countries promoted their output as a nation to other nations in terms of their furniture and design skills. And then that started to take root. And obviously now Danish and Scandinavian furniture is really highly regarded.
Now it's time for me to meet an internationally renowned Sheffield designer in person. Patrick's kindly offered to drive me out to the HQ of David Meller Design, about 10 miles outside of the city in the Peak District National Park. David Meller was a Sheffield native and one of Britain's most famous designers. The company that bears his name is now run by his son, Corin, who's a designer in his own right. I'm hopefully going to talk to Corin about the company and about design in Sheffield more generally. To begin with, do you just want to tell me a little bit about your company, the history of your company, and the way in which that history is intertwined with the history of the city?
The company goes back quite a long way. Certainly for as a design company, we go back to the sort of early roots of design, I suppose, and the Festival of Britain and Britain Can Make It. My father trained at the RCA in London and set up his first silversmithing workshop in Sheffield. He then got involved in designing all aspects of street furniture, including the traffic lights we all stop at every day, and then also took on many silver commissions. In the 70s, we actually started manufacturing, and I think that's really what we're mainly known for now, is actually manufacturing knives and forks. But there's much more to the company than just manufacturing. We're, I suppose, a design company through and through, in that we believe the best products are things that we've actually designed. They're also things that we've made, and very importantly to us, they're also things that we actually sell. So we have our own shops. So I suppose the other bit of design that runs through the whole company is the architecture of our buildings. So it's sort of designed through and through, not just sort of superficial surface design.
Your foreman in the factory was telling me that all the staff are trained to do all the jobs. So there's continuity in the manufacture process and people have a more holistic idea about the thing they're making. Where did you inherit this design philosophy from?
Well, I think it goes back to my father again. I think we sort of felt purely from a sort of a making point of view that we like the idea that people actually manufacturing the things that we've designed actually take pride in what they're doing. So the old sort of Sheffield philosophy that somebody worked on a press for 8 hours a day and they'd finish their shift was totally what we didn't want to do. So therefore, all the workforce rotate around, so they'll only spend a couple of hours actually doing one job. But also, probably more importantly, they can see the whole process really from, or they're involved in the whole manufacturing process from start to finish.
If Sheffield is going to grow and evolve as a design city, it'll need to invest in young talent. I'm back in Sheffield now, and on my way to Block Projects, a contemporary art space in a renovated cutlery and tuning fork workshop in the centre of town. I'm going to talk to some people involved in Design Week projects meant to engage local students and young designers.
I'm Renata Thierstruck and I work at the School of Architecture, University of Sheffield. I'm running a studio there called Future Works with Julia Udall.
Hi, I'm Julia Udall and I'm on the Stories of Change project and I'm also part of the Architecture Department at the University of Sheffield.
Hi, my name's Charlotte Morgan and I'm the Creative Director at Block Projects, which is a contemporary art gallery in the middle of Sheffield.
And that's where we are right now, in Block Projects. You've got an exhibition on called One Great Workshop, which is tying in with Sheffield Design Week. Do you want to tell me what that's about?
The title, One Great Workshop, comes from the very particular nature of Sheffield's industry, which was lots of small factories where people would collaborate across different factories and come together to make a single item. And we're basically today working with some students from the University Technical College to get them to think about the past, present and future of energy and industry in the city.
As an industrial design powerhouse, Sheffield was internationally significant. Do you see the city becoming internationally significant again in this new design era where we're moving away from heavy industry design?
I think it's already internationally significant. You know, a lot of the partners that we've been working with in the region are doing incredible things with industry. The AMRC, which is the Advanced Manufacturing Research Centre, is one of the catapult centres in the UK for industry. There are advances in robotics here at the university. There are all sorts of interesting things going on. And in terms of arts and designs, those things are very connected with industry as well in Sheffield.
Another interesting example is Gripple, actually, who are an employee-owned company, and they're really innovative and looking to massively expand, but they're really interested in the kind of research and development side of things. And certainly for the students that will be joining us today from the University Technical College, they're really keen to kind of work at these really kind of cutting-edge places.
My last appointment of the day is with Ian Anderson. Ian is the founder of seminal Sheffield graphic design studio, The Designers Republic, and is also Creative Director of Communications for Sheffield Design Week. Could you tell me a little bit about the history of Designers Republic, specifically in relation to Sheffield and its history in the city?
We always refer to the Designers Republic being declared, and it was declared on Bastille Day 1986. And at the time, as in any city, there were a few smallish design agencies, marketing agencies, advertising agencies. But Sheffield doesn't have a real history of commerce, as does Manchester or Leeds. So the design industry is not the same as you would have in a bigger city where there's a lot of commercial enterprises needing or desiring design input. So when we started, really, we kind of started by accident. Because of my background in the music industry and through running magazines and promoting gigs, etc., in the city, basically, we were asked to design a record cover and then another one and then another one. And then there was a big article in Blueprint about us, and then there was one in NME about us, and all of a sudden we were the flavour of the month, if you like. So late 80s, all through the 90s and early sort of 2000s, we were perceived to be really influential, both nationally and globally, which obviously put us on the map in Sheffield. But the point in Sheffield is that there's not so many places or things to design, or there weren't historically. And of course, that's changing now, and people are more open to it and seeing the benefit of good design and good communication. So I guess that in a lot of ways, we inadvertently trailblazed Sheffield as being a design hub. And now there's a lot of designers who would normally have had to go to Manchester or London or even abroad, you know, now stay in Sheffield because it's okay to do that.
Well, my time in Sheffield has come to an end, and I've certainly been impressed with what I've seen. Corin Meller, who I spoke to earlier, has said that Sheffield's past is in manufacturing, but its future is in design. If that's true, then Sheffield is certainly investing in its future. Other post-industrial cities looking to reinvigorate their creative industries might be well advised to take note. For Monocle 24, in Sheffield, I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan.
That's it for this week's 2015 look back over our favourite moments from Section D. My thanks to Monocle's contributing editor Tom Morris, design correspondent David Pleasant, and ever patient regular editor Alex Funnell for their sterling work on the show throughout the year, and of course to our regular listeners and subscribers for making it all possible. Today's show was produced by Henry Rhys Sheridan and expertly edited by Chris Chilvers. If you have any comments, queries or suggestions, you can drop Henry a note at hrs@monocle.com. And of course, you can always listen again or just brush up on our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much and goodbye.